Tundra Talk is brought to you by Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware, your locally owned source for hunting, fishing, and shooting gear in interior Alaska. They sell proven gear that'll tackle whatever Alaskan task you need it to, and Frontier always stays current with gear for the season. Whether you're baiting bears in the spring, fishing, camping, or dip netting in the summer, you're looking for game bags and moose camp gear in the fall, if you need to stock up on trapping lures or just get everything you need to go ice fishing, they've got you covered. They always carry a wide variety of Alaskan-proven clothing and boots, camping gear, meat processing supplies, guns, ammo, reloading and shooting supplies, as well as camping gear and backpacking food. Downstairs in Century Hardware, you'll find a full hardware store naturally, and you'll also find your snow machine, ATV, and marine accessories down there. They go out of their way to stock plenty of quality, useful equipment. And whether you're gearing up for a hunting or fishing trip, working on a never-ending home improvement project, or anything in between, it's usually a one-stop shop. Frontier Outfitters is located on 3rd and Old Steese in Fairbanks, and they have a second location in North Pole, so make sure you stop in next time you need to gear up. This episode of Tundra Talk is also brought to you by Hedgecock Group Realtor Rick Lindsay, a guy that can take care of just about any of your real estate needs in the Fairbanks area. Now, the Hedgecock Group has been in Fairbanks North Pole real estate market since the early 80s, and their service is tailored to meet the diverse needs of home buyers in interior Alaska. Now, Rick has lived in Fairbanks for a long time and understands a lot of the less obvious ins and outs of buying and selling property around here. You know, things like water holding tanks and permafrost and all that jazz. Fairbanks is a really unique place to live, and having a realtor that knows what to look for in a quality place can make all the difference. Rick's a Marine Corps veteran and will work hard to get you exactly what you need. And if you're looking to buy or sell real estate in the Fairbanks or North Pole area, reach out to Rick at 907-378-6780 and go check out his Instagram at RLINDSEY113, at RLINDSEY113. He's really a passionate outdoorsman. He's just like us. He's one of us, and he loves to share his adventures on there, and he's got a pretty nice cranker of a ram that I'm jealous of. So go check him out. I know there's lots of you out there that dream of moving to Alaska, but it's a big step and can be kind of intimidating. Landing a solid job before you move can make things run a lot smoother, but you might not be sure of the job market or even really where to look. Now, if you're an experienced ASC certified or GM factory trained technician, I've got good news for you. Chevrolet GMC of Fairbanks is looking to hire qualified service department techs, and they've got enough work to keep you pretty much as busy as you want to be. Fairbanks Chevy has a very busy shop, but they allow for flexible scheduling. They offer top market pay rates with paid overtime, a great benefits package with 401k retirement plan with contribution matching, and you know, for a service tech, you can really make a good solid living. They can offer relocation assistance to help get you up here, paid training to get you spun up, and they have a well-lit and well-maintained facility, and these are all things that help contribute to a great work atmosphere. On top of all that, they make it a priority to allow you to take your vacation time during hunting season, something that is really tough in the service and construction industries here in Fairbanks and can sometimes be a deal breaker for folks like us. Good help and hard workers are always welcome in Fairbanks, and if this is the opportunity you've been waiting for, apply at fairbankschevy.com or call their service manager, Rick Lindsay, directly at 907-215-6444.
That's how you do it.
Welcome back to Tundra Talk, everybody. I'm Tyler Friel. Now, this is going to be kind of a follow-up episode to a reloading episode I did a while back covering just all the general basics of what hand loading is and how you do it and some of the tools involved. I've had several people write in asking for me to do a little bit more specific episode, I don't know, like fully advanced, but just like a little bit more advanced episode on rehand loading and kind of talking about my specific methods. And there's a lot of ways to do it. Mine is not the only way. And I'm not, by far, not the most advanced reloader out there. So there's things that, I can do better as well. But I'll go ahead and walk through like all the, the methods I use and kind of why I do it that way. And maybe like even add some things that I could do to get more consistency and be a little better at it. And I'll also talk about some of the, like the testing I've been doing that actually simplifies things greatly for hand loading. I think I was in the middle of it on the last episode, and have kind of wrapped that up. And I'm always doing some kind of testing, but not just load development testing, but also some of the interesting things I've been seeing from experimenting with larger sample sizes and how to plot and record that data for both hand loading purposes and just like zeroing your rifle or evaluating hunting ammunition, or just really like wanting to know what you can truly expect from your hunting rifle, kind of the outer boundaries of what you can expect from that hunting rifle. Cause that practically is what helps you in the field. It's not having a number, you know, a group size number to brag about on your rifle. That doesn't do you any good. What does do you good is truly like knowing what you can expect. So anyway, I'll roll right into that kind of chronologically with the way I do things. And I'll preface this with saying that for consistent ammo, consistent ammo, you want consistent practices and quality tools that are going to give you consistent results. That's just saying consistent a lot of times, but it's really true. Some of the practices may not matter as much in the big picture, but the more you can strive for consistency, it's not going to hurt anything. So keep that in mind as you go through everything, and that kind of will hopefully make some of this stuff make sense as I'm explaining it too. So I'll start with brass prep and maybe even brass selection. You know, if you got a hunting rifle, you're either going to order brass or use factory brass that you've shot through your rifle. And the key, like probably the biggest or the only, I don't know, the only thing that I'd say really matters to like an average reloader or hunter is just consistency of your brass. Is you want the same head stamp, same manufacturer, and ideally the same lot of brass. Because there are some variations, you know, whether it's Federal or Hornady or anybody, like lot to lot of brass that they produce, there are some small variations, so that can contribute to a little bit of inconsistency. And the exception to that, of course, for me is pistol stuff, handgun stuff, or small, like 30 carbine stuff that I'm not really worried wrapped around the axle that much about accuracy. I just want brass that'll work and I can shoot, and so I don't really care about that. I'll mix brass all day long, So if I've got my rifle brass that I want to use, you know, whatever manufacturer that is, all the same manufacturer, ideally the same lot, sometimes not. And ideally the same firing, the same number of firings on the brass. I don't always follow this. Like one of my big, huge boxes of 6.5 Creedmoor brass, I haven't really kept track of, and it's mixed firings. And that will generate some inconsistency in the next, because as you fire and rework brass, it thins out and moves, and the neck will harden up, and so you'll get slightly inconsistent neck tensions. You know, how much does that matter? Like, I can't really say because I haven't done extensive, like, calculated testing on it, but that's a matter of if you have the same number of firings, you're going to have much more, or ideally, you know, in theory, much more consistent brass. So, in the first part of the process, I used to clean before I resized, but now I resize before I clean. Simply, it just seems like I have a cleaner brass product at the end, as opposed to getting, you know, resizing lubricant all over the brass after it's already clean. So I'll take brass and run it through a sizer. I use a mix, but mostly mandrel neck sizing dies to set the neck tension. And what I mean by the neck tension is what happens after you fire a piece of brass is that case neck is expanded, and you take a spent piece of brass and you could drop a bullet right down through the neck. It won't hold it. So you're, in addition to like bumping the shoulder back and, you know, resizing the case body, you're wanting to resize that neck too. Now that squeezes the neck down to the point where it will hold the bullet consistently. And neck tension is just like, you know, what we use to describe like how tightly that neck is, holds that bullet. For the most consistent results, you want the most consistent neck tension. And there's different theories and different people like prefer different methods for resizing necks. The two main ones are going to be like a mandrel neck expander and a neck bushing die. Now a neck mandrel expander is mostly what I use, just because I guess I just haven't really dove into the intricacies of that and like really experimented with what's going to give me measurably more consistent results. I have no problem loading accurate ammo with neck mandrels, but they do have their they do have some of their disadvantages. Now, what that is, those come in just your standard full length resizing die, and it's on the decapping rod. So there's that rod that knocks the primer out, like we talked on the last episode. But above that, there's usually a little ball or kind of football shaped round doohickey on the mandrel that, when you're resizing the brass, initially goes down through the neck, pops the primer out, and then the neck is sized down from the outside. And then as you pull that thing back through, it expands the neck back out to the correct size. Now you can get, you know, some of the downsides of this is you can, in theory, it's a little bit less consistent than the bushing dies. So bushing dies basically have these, you can interchange different diameter bushings that squeeze the neck down to exactly the size you want. Some of my older, like National Match 308 dies have this. So it's, you don't have that mandrel expanding the neck back out. Rather, you just size it to exactly where you want it from the outside. On a standard sizing die, it's going to squeeze it a little bit beyond where it needs to be and then pull it back out. So the downside of the neck mandrel is it is a little sensitive to like case neck lubrication. And sometimes, you know, if you're getting a little light on case neck lube, as you're pulling the casing back out of the die, it hits like a lot of resistance and you kind of crunch over it. Well, what that can do is that can kind of reverse some of your sizing of the shoulder, especially, you know, if it's a cartridge like most that we're shooting are going to headspace off the shoulder. Little after you've already pushed that shoulder back, it'll pull the shoulder back out a little bit, but you never know how much or how, you know, when it's going to do it. So just keep that in mind. For the average reloader, like, it's not something you're going to need to worry about. But it can introduce some inconsistency. So I still use them a lot, and that's just the way I do it. So I'll resize, then I'll kind of wipe my case lube off, and then throw them in dry media tumbler, just a vibratory case tumbler. I'll usually use some brass polish in there, run them overnight till they're nice and shiny, strain them, pull them out, and then I will, before priming, I'll go through all the cases and poke out, because a lot of times that tumbling media, little pieces of it will get stuck in your flash hole, and you just want to make sure that all those are cleared out. Now, one thing I used to do that I am not doing anymore, is deburring the flash hole. And I think I talked about that maybe in the last episode, and for a long time I've done it just like, cause why not? It's helps make things more consistency. But, you know, as a lot of stuff I've learned and regurgitated from what the Hornady guys have actually been doing experimentation with is, you know, large sample testing of, like deburred versus not deburred flash holes, and they found that there's really not any perceptible difference. That's just what their data said, and it kind of, you know, I don't know, like I haven't done the experimentation to tell for sure, but it's one of these things that, like, I always did because someone told me it made a difference, and why not? So if you want to do it, that's totally fine. There, you can get the little tools to do it, but I probably will not be doing much of that in the future at all. So after cleaning the cases, you know, clearing out, making sure the flash holes are clear, I'll prime them with a hand priming tool. And, no, actually I skipped a step. So rewind back a little bit. After I size them, I'll wipe the case lube off. Before I clean them, I will trim and chamfer and deburr them. Now, I use a motorized, like, Frankfurt Arsenal trimmer that I've used for quite a while. It's not quite as precise as, you know, as a little hand crank trimmer, and the hand crank trimmers are fine. But it's much faster, and the cases are pretty much all within like a couple thousandths lengthwise. And, you know, you don't have to size brass or trim brass every time. I would say what I do it if I see inconsistencies in length, and you will as you fire brass. Everyone's just a little bit different and they behave a little differently. So, but all, you know, every reloading manual has the like maximum case overall length and the trim length that you're supposed to trim it to. So if my brass is like real consistent, I'll measure, you know, 10 or 15 pieces of it. And if it's real consistent in length and it's not over and it's not like right at or beyond the max case overall length, then I won't bother trimming it. But if it is inconsistent or it is at that, you know, I'll trim it back to what the spec says. And, you know, trim it and then, you know, chamfer the inside of the case neck and the outside if there's a little bit of a burr on there, just to deburr the case. And then I'll clean and proceed from there. But I prime with pretty much exclusively hand priming tools. I like the Frankfurt Arsenal one. I have a couple of RCBS ones. They work really well. And the Frankfurt one is pretty cool because you can set the priming, the primer depth on it. Some cases, and not often, but I have run into cases where they've got like a little bit deep primer pockets, and it was a lot of 4570 brass that I did that had deep primer pockets, and just using a regular primer thing, I would actually get inconsistent ignition, not super bad, but enough to make me not want to use that ammo in the field. And so I didn't have this then, but what I would try now, and I probably should eventually when I get around to it, is adjusting that primer depth to where it's perfectly flush and right where I want it. But that cedar comes with a nice case holder set, and it's really quick to swap between all the different cartridges. When it comes to, you know, charging up cases with powder, and I have a couple different automatic dispensers, and I have a Redding benchtop mounted powder drop or powder meter, and a couple different tricklers, and I use the electronic ones a lot. I have one of the older RCBS Chargemaster lights and one of the newer RCBS Matchmaster Pros for dispensing powder. And these ones, they're, you know, electronic scale attached that you calibrate everything and then tell it the weight to drop and hit go. And then they'll dispense powder and beep when they're done and give you a final measurement, and you can fine tune it. The Matchmaster Pro has a resolution of down to the hundredths, where like some of the older scales are just down to the tenth of a grain. And I'm hesitant to do just blind powder drops. I do sometimes with powder that meters really well, like some of the ball powder that just throws really consistently out of a manual powder meter, powder drop that's got the hopper and a micrometer, you know, adjustment to adjust the volume and then a handle to flip it up and down. You know, like my old service rifle loads that I used Accurate 2520, which is a real fine ball powder and is very precise to meter. So once I got my meter set and make sure I'm throwing the correct charge weight, then I just throw them and like check every 10th one or something, but just to be anal. And being anal, like it's not a bad thing when it comes to reloading and consistency. It's very detail oriented, and you just want to make sure and have all your shit in a row. And make sure you're doing things correctly and consistently to be safe and produce good ammo. So, there's the automatic dispensers do have some downsides. Like, it's nice that they run on their own. Some powders, and sometimes it may not be the fastest way to go. Because I've got two of them now. A lot of times, if I'm loading a big batch and I want to like auto dispense every charge, I'll have them both running at the same time, and that's a little bit quicker. But I always am pretty paranoid about like double checking loads, especially when I first start dropping powder, running powder through one of them. They have a warm-up cycle, and then when you start running powder through them, I'm pretty anal about double-checking my powder charge on another scale that's calibrated, one of my older like RCBS scales that I know what that pan's supposed to weigh or what that pan weighs, so I can tell if it's calibrated immediately. And I'll just double check. And then once I've got everything set up, I'll just roll with it. But one of the most efficient ways you can do it manually is to get a good powder meter, like a Redding or Frankford makes a really nice one, and a powder drop and a good digital scale and a trickler. And you should have a trickler anyway, but you load that trickler up and you get your scale, your meter set to where it's dropping charges about, a couple tenths of a grain under where you want it. Drop a charge, set it on the scale, and trickle up to like the exact tenth of a grain. With a lot of stick powders, those meters will vary by like two to three tenths of a grain sometimes. And like getting into, what some more of the stuff the Hornady guys saw in their experimentation is that, and all factory ammo is basically like this, that those little variations don't really make as big of a difference as we might think they do. Now, I still like measuring, having everything to the tenth of a grain, basically, or within a tenth of a grain. I don't think that hurts you at all. But there's a lot of people who use progressive presses, and those are just powder drops, is all they use. They're not measuring everything to a tenth of a grain or tighter. So just keep that in mind. I think for the average hunter, like if you get your load set, and you get your powder meter set to dropping, maybe average 10 drops. And if it's right where you want it to be on that average, and it'll vary back and forth a little bit, then, I would just call that good. I wouldn't get too wrapped around the axle about fine tuning it, but you can if you want. And then, after you drop all your powder, you got bullet seeding, and that's, there's a lot of different styles of dyes, from the very primitive to like nice micrometer adjustable seeding dyes. The biggest thing I do like having, the seeding dyes that have a sleeve or tube that extends down from the inside of the die to line the bullet up with the case. Some of the more basic like RCBS dies don't have this, and they just kind of have like, a plug or whatever, fitting on the top that presses on the top of the bullet that's up in the case. And once you can set the bullet in there, sometimes they're not going to want to stay or be perfectly straight. And as you press that cartridge up into the die, like you don't really know what that thing is doing. And I've smashed necks and you don't know what it's doing to your neck tension if the thing's kind of starts to force it in there crooked and then kind of straightens itself out. It's just a little bit less consistent. So, probably my favorite so far, like my Redding match dies that have a number adjustable micrometer for the seating depth. Like you can fine tune it to the thousandth, and they have a nice like spring loaded sleeve that guides the bullet and lines it up like with really good concentricity straight into that case neck. So you don't get any, if you feel any like big bumps and stuff like that when you're seating bullets, like, your stuff is probably not going to be as consistent as you would like it to be. So, and Hornady's dies, I think all of their seating dies have a sleeve. It's not a spring loaded sleeve like the Redding dies, but it is a sleeve that extends down, like a wizard. No, but, I got my Borat jokes I got myself cracking up here. So set your bullet in the case, and as soon as it goes up and gets into that sleeve lines it up and keeps it lined up through the seating process. So, I've had really good luck with those dies as well. Those dies, like they're general, I think you can order custom like match seating dies from Hornady, and I think they have a micrometer that's like click adjustable to the thousandth now that can be retrofit on some other dies. I'm not really totally up on it, but their basic die sets are not micrometer. Like, it's just a threaded screw basically, or bolt that you're working up and down. Or I like to start when I'm, this is a good thing to address too. So when I'm setting my seating depth on like new cartridge, I always start high and just gradually lower it, even with a micrometer. Like, I gradually lower it and lower it until the cartridge measures the overall length I want, and I got the seating depth I want. Because it's all, you know, rather than just guess first and then maybe have to like pull bullets or something, you know, I will start low, work down to the depth I want, and then run them. And that works pretty well. If you're resetting up your dies, and sometimes if I'm resetting up dies and I have like, you know, I already have cartridges that I know I want to match that seating depth, I'll throw a live cartridge in there, run the RAM up, thread the seating die down there to where it's not quite, it's not going to give it a crimp or anything, but down to the appropriate depth. And then I will, and start with the seating stem high, and I'll screw the seating stem down there until it touches the bullet. And I'll usually back it off a touch, like an eighth of a turn, and then size one and measure from there. And I don't want, you know, you can, if you just like thread it down tight, you can mess with that cartridge and you're still not going to be right dead nuts on. So that just gets me a lot closer. And I just have a couple little adjustments to make before I'm where I want to be, and measure everything. Like, get a good set of digital calipers. And if you know how to use them, those cartridge, like OAL gauge guides that measure like on the ogive of the bullet. I typically, a lot of them will just measure extreme overall length, you know, and that gets me within a couple thousandths. So, I'll just measure the cartridge overall. But the little gauges, if you know how to like compensate, are that sit on the ogive and give you a nice flat surface for your calipers on both ends. Those are a slightly more accurate way of doing it. And, yeah, I mean, that's basically what I do to load my stuff. I don't do anything too fancy. One of the things I could do that would probably improve my brass life and consistency a little bit is annealing, and which is like heat treating basically your necks to soften them up, and so that they don't get hard, and it'll give you more consistent neck tension and longer brass life as you're constantly working that brass back and forth. But I've been told, and it makes sense that if you're going to anneal, do it every time, rather than some of the times, because the process starts over once that brass has been fired and heated up and expanded, and you need to like heat treat that or anneal that again to kind of reset it to a softer state, from what I understand. Like I said, I'm kind of a mongoloid when it comes to some of this stuff, and that's just something that I haven't done yet. So, one of these days I'm sure I will, and that would probably improve my consistency, but that's a popular method. I never messed around with neck turning. I know some people who have done it and kind of quit, but that can change things too, by like removing material from your neck. You're thinning out your neck, rather than just, thinning it out from the outside to match your chamber rather than just using the same material. So I don't know. I never got into it, and it sounds like a lot of people are not really, or people that have been doing it are going away or quitting doing it. They're just not seeing like measurable, like any positive results from it. So take that for what it's worth and you can look into it, but I don't ever bother with that. So kind of the funner part of reloading, sometimes frustrating, is load development. And I guess that's like maybe the more interesting thing, rather than just the practices and the fundamentals of how to reload. What we really want to know is like, how can we create ammunition for this rifle that shoots, you know, whether it's better than factory is ideal, or the best shooting load. Now, I was used to believe, and a lot of people do believe, that you could take basically any rifle, and as long, you know, once you find that secret recipe for it, that secret, you know, whatever the combination of bullet and powder and charge weight and seating depth, like if you could find that, like you could make any rifle shoot. And it's just, this is not true. I don't believe that any longer, and I don't waste my time trying to make a rifle something it isn't. You know, there are ways to, you know, and we do want to like optimize, like have the best shooting load we can. But I think that has really been simplified. And I, you know, I'm pretty sure I mentioned it on the last episode. And a lot of this is kind of like regurgitating what the Hornady guys have said on their podcast with sample size and load development methods. But I mean, I've been experimenting with it for myself, and it's, so far it's all seeming to be very valid and true and logical. And you know, a lot of this stuff or these principles are like, have been around for a long time, but it's just not, it's like people are kind of having an awakening to it or discovering like, that some stuff really doesn't matter as much as we maybe thought it did. 'Cause there's a big line in this kind of stuff, you know, whether it's just picking a hunting rifle or how to reload. A lot of these like kind of generational, generational skills or practices that we have a lot of emotional investment in. Like people get pretty defensive of the way they do things. And I'm sure I do too, but defensive of the way they do things, sometimes to a point of fault where they're, you know, you're like ignoring real evidence that suggests like, hey, you probably should be doing this, or like, no, you're wasting your time doing this or that, you know, like we've gone through. And I think maybe I went through the old ways of doing load development where, you know, me and everybody else that I knew, you would do, you know, small samples of different charge weights, and you'd find like your charge weight that shot the best. And then you would load some more of those and play with seating depth and pick the one of those that shot the best. And then, you know, that's what you call your load development. And so many times you end up like shocked by like, oh, like just weird stuff that happens. You know, you load up 50 of them, take them and shoot a 5-shot group, and it's like way beyond what you thought, or even a 3-shot group, and it's way bigger than you thought it should be. So then you start making excuses and say, I don't know how many times I've said that, oh, that had to be, I had to have pulled that shot. You know, something happened on that shot, you know, and you just come up with excuses. And when really, like, if you're pretty tuned up to shooting and you shoot a lot, like, you know, when you pull something, like, are the crosshairs on the trigger are the crosshairs on the target when that trigger breaks? Like, then, no, you probably didn't pull it. Like, you know when you pull a shot. And, yeah, I've noticed that even a lot of shots where I'm like, that, like, didn't quite feel right when it broke, you know, the bullet's still, like, right in there where it's supposed to be. So, I mean, it takes more than, you know, when you're set up with good, you know, good stable rest and good fundamentals, like it's, you can outshoot a lot of guns. But that, I mean, that's just the theme that I see when you're dealing with accuracy, that anything that falls outside of your expectations is very easily written off. A lot of people will just write it off as, oh, I pulled that, or must've been a cold, you know, must've been this or that or something. So, there's all that, but I'll get into actually like the, so, I mean, lose my train of thought here, but the load develop. So that's kind of how you would do load development. You use small samples of a bunch of different variables, and you try to isolate variables, and then you pick the best one, and then you change another variable, maybe your primer, or if you're into that, or seating depth, stuff like that. And then you pick the best one of those, and that's your load. And a lot of times that's a little disappointing, and it's freaking time consuming, you know, and time and ammo consuming, you know, if you're, you know, a lot of the ladder tests, or like velocity ladder tests, impact ladder tests, which you kind of like are,
you know, at longer ranges, like, I mean, that's going to be a factor of your velocity, or like a common OCW test, which is an impact test, like testing different charge weights to see like where, you know, three charge weights in a row have the tightest, you know, the closest points of impact. You know, it's like, oh, well, that's like the most accurate node, people would call it. And that's where everything lines up. So that's what I'm going to go with. And a lot of times it just doesn't, you know, it doesn't always pan out the way you think it will, especially with less accurate rifle systems. If you're shooting like a top of the line rifle with, you know, the best components and the best practices and all this, like you know, if your gun's going to shoot, it's going to shoot pretty well. And if you know, if you get the powder and bullet combination that gun likes, like it's going to shoot well no matter what. But you can, using small samples, you get tricked into thinking that there's, you know, this is the optimal charge weight, you know, or to a degree, this is the optimal seating depth. So I'll, you know, I'll kind of walk into, I'll walk through like a little bit of this testing I did and explain what happened and how it's changed my load development or simplified my load development greatly. And that'll be that. So what I did, you know, and the story is on outdoorlife.com. I think if you Google rifle nodes, it should be up there pretty high in the results. Yeah, so it's right at the top. If you just Google rifle nodes, N-O-D-E-S, this story and like all the details and data are right there at the top. So, you know, I, like I said, I heard the Hornady guys talking about this, and they are, have been done a really good job at like presenting a lot of this, like large sample size stuff is not new at all. It's just like, I know I didn't really understand it. And even after starting to listen to some of theirs, the way they presented it, it's taken me about a year to like, for it to really click and be like, oh, this is what, you know, this is what the deal is. So, this spring I did this kind of experiment for myself, to see if these nodes exist and like what maybe is true or not true involving load development or specifically powder charge weights. So I just picked three rifles. I picked it's a Savage 110 carbon that I kind of hate that, right? I hate shooting that gun, but it shoots so well that it's like a really good test rifle. It's got a proof barrel on it and 223. And I picked a kind of like generic hunting rifle, 6.5 Creedmoor, the new Ruger, Ruger American Gen 2, which turns out to be like a pretty good shooting rifle, a really good shooting rifle for what it is. And then my old like beater 30-06 Remington Model 710, which I always thought of as like, yeah, pretty good shooting gun. And it's not bad for what it is, but I'll expound on that in a little bit. But I wanted like an example of a budget gun, because if there's any gun that can benefit from like fine-tuning your load development and finding the powder bullet combination it shoots the best, or charge weight combination it shoots the best, it would be a budget gun, because I will always like just considered them to be I just took it for a fact that, all right, they're going to be more picky, they're going to be less forgiving, so like they should in theory benefit more from these like, you know, velocity ladder node tests or like an OCW node test. So anyway, I took all three of these. I just kind of randomly picked bullets that I had enough of to complete the test. So with the 223, it was a Hornady. I had a case of Hornady 68 grain Bote hollow points. The 6.5, I had 143 ELDXs. And the 30-06, I had 150 grain Hornady inner bonds. And it wasn't like, I mean, it was just coincidence. They were all Hornady. It's what I had, literally had like several hundred of to do this test. So I set out and I worked up. I picked powder for each gun, 223. I'd had good results with like Hodgdon benchmark in the past, so I picked that. I picked H4350 for 6.5 Creedmoor. That's like a classic 6.5 Creed powder, or and a I say classic. It hasn't been around long enough to be a classic, but that's like a strong go-to powder. And I picked IMR 4350 for the 30-06 because that's what I always used to load for my 30-06. So taking those powders and bullets, I worked up and seating all the bullets at just like book spec seating depth. And I took all of those and I worked up velocities, velocity ladders. I loaded up enough of the same charge weights for to do a velocity ladder, like a Satterlee style velocity ladder test, which is like one shot per charge weight. And then I also loaded the same charge weights for an OCW test, which is that, you know, it takes three shots per charge weight and you coordinate them like the impact points of the three closest groups that are consecutive. And I went and recorded like all the velocities and shot all these ladder tests, you know, all under the same conditions, like same barrel conditions, like clean barrel after this, and shot five Fowlers. Then took that and calculated my nodes, and some of them were different, some of them were the same. So I calculated these nodes, which should be the most forgiving spots in this charge weight, according in this charge weight spectrum. And I was covering basically from minimum load to maximum load, book safe loads. I've calculated what I call my velocity node from the velocity node ladder, from the velocity ladder, my accuracy node, I think I called it, from the OCW test. And then I also looked at the data to see like the biggest jumps in velocity or the biggest, you know, yeah, the velocity ante node would be the biggest jumps in velocity from shot to shot. So if you had a huge extreme spread from like a much bigger extreme spread in one area, and then, you know, your velocity node in theory is going to be the smallest extreme spread between like three consecutive charge weights. So I selected like an ante node, or what should be the least forgiving spot for each charge weight. And then I wanted to fill in my data set with a fourth point, which I just, I basically picked to fill in any gaps. You know, if the upper two-thirds of the charge weight spectrum were taken up by like the velocity node and OCW node and the ante node, then I would just pick minimum charge. I picked one like minimum charge weight, and all this data is in the story. So basically what I did, I loaded up 30 shot samples of all these charge weights that spanned the entire like book minimum to book maximum charge weight, and went and shot them all under like, there was some temperature variability, you know, between some of the days of shooting, and that does play a little bit. A lot of those powders, like you might see like half a foot per second to a foot per second per degree difference. So there's a little bit of velocity difference, but basically like all my accuracy results within each rifle, like, were exactly the same. The only trend I saw, and the Hornady guys kind of like mentioned this too, that they saw it, was that the accuracy got slightly worse with increased charge weight. But velocity, basically, there's no plateaus. The velocity, like plot of velocity with these four like large sample sizes, is perfectly linear. So the more charge weight, the higher the velocity. And what am I thinking? I'm thinking I need a beer, but it's like 10 o'clock in the morning. So the velocity is basically linear, and the extreme spread, or like the total 30 shot cumulative group size, is, it varied a little bit, but that was basically the same. It was within the margin of error of 30 shot group sizes. And a little bit more informative, using the mean radius of those 30 shot groups, they were like virtually identical. And that's a little bit more informative because it counts every single shot, not just your two worst. You know, there will be some human error in there, but your mean radius like is a much more detailed picture of what that whole data set is doing. And like I said, with every all three rifles, all three powder types, the entire spectrum, like the mean radiuses are like almost identical. So, I mean, it just shows me that by changing your powder weight, like you're going to change velocity, but you're not really going to change accuracy. The only accuracy change you might see is if you jump to like minimum charge weight, it's going to be the most accurate. And it was the minimum charge weight was the most accurate in every single test case with the same powder. So these like spots where I always change every 0.3 grains or 0.5 grains and then try to hone in on that like magic number. It's just a waste of time. It doesn't exist. Like it doesn't work like that. And what the Hornady guys have said, and I kind of like seem to be verifying as true in my own testing and shooting, is that, you know, if you want to like, if a bullet and powder combination isn't shooting well, like it's, you're not going to make it shoot well, you know, and you're just spinning your wheels. And this also comes into sample size, which I'll talk into a little bit, because I shot these 30 shot groups in increments. I shot a series of 3-shot groups and then finished in a series of 5-shot groups. I think I shot, 15 rounds of 3-shot groups. So five 3-shot groups and 3 5-shot groups, and then compiled them all into a 30-shot aggregate. So, I could see plain as day, like the variability of these 3-shot group sizes and the 5-shot group sizes. From charge weight to charge weight, they vary a lot. But when you aggregate them all into, you know, all of a charge weight samples into one 30 shot group, like it's exactly the same as the other ones of that powder. So, that was like mind blowing to me, and to see it work like that consistently was pretty powerful. And it really like cemented some major changes in the way I do load development, which ultimately is just going to save, it's going to save me ammo and time and money and gunpowder. Cause all that stuff is just it can get really involved when you're chasing these little groups around trying to optimize things. And you ultimately, you know, best case, you're no better off than you were if you just like try to powder charge and maybe adjusted it a little bit to fine tune velocity that you're going for, but just tried some. And worst case, you burn up 100 or 150 rounds, you know, like a pound or 2 pounds, whatever, a gunpowder chasing your tail to end up right back where you started and ultimately decide that shit ain't going to work. And ask me, because I've done this, like I've done this, I don't know how many times. And, it's pretty sobering to realize like how much time I've burnt spinning my wheels over the years. So, my method, like the way I approach I approach working up a load now for whatever rifle it is, hunting rifle, match rifle, whatever it may be, is I will pick a powder that is like try to do some research and find like a known gunpowder, good powder for that caliber, and pick what I think is going to be a good bullet or bullet I want to use. And, powder, especially now, I mean, even still, some powder is coming back, but it's not, and who knows when it will, if ever, be like it used to be, where you could just go pick any number of like 15 powders for your cartridge. So I'll pick a powder, I'll pick a bullet, and usually I'll look at the book loads, back off a max load by like a grain and a half, 2 grains, 3 grains, and just load 10 of them. And I load them at the book spec seating depth for whatever that bullet is. Or, you know, and most of the time the book spec is inside magazine length. I'll load them at book spec, go shoot I'll shoot 2 5-shot groups and compile them into a 10 shot group, while recording the velocities. And that's not like data I can hang my hat on, because there is a lot of variability. But if that looks good to me, then I'll load 20 and I'll shoot 4 or 5 shot groups and compile them into a 20 shot group. And if that looks good and I like where that's at, then I'm done. Like, load development done. Check. Move on. And if I don't like that, then I'll like, or it blows up, something like weird happens and I really don't like it, I just try a different powder. And, you know, I'm seeing like in some of these calibers, trying a lot of different powders with the same bullets. And like, you will see like interesting, like velocity SD numbers and stuff like that. But, the key to getting, and I'm finding the key to getting like reliable expect, you know, numbers and that you can kind of hang your hat on and set expectations with, is shooting large volume. Like, you know, I do a lot of 20 shot samples, and doing 20 shot samples, like even with factory ammo and some of these rifles, you know, you see the variability in these small, in these, you know, 3 or 5 shot group sizes, and they move around, but they move around a lot. Like 4 or 5 shot groups is not equal to 120 shot group. Like, because I always did used to do this, and in some ways we will present like riding, reviewing guns and outdoor life. Like, we'll still include like some average group sizes because that's what everybody's brain is calibrated to, but it's not nearly as meaningful as like a 20 shot group size. And that doesn't mean just like sit there and hum 20 rounds at a whack necessarily. Most of these rifles, I'm shooting them in either 3 or 5 shot increments, letting a barrel cool, shoot them again, and then compiling those shots, like correlating those shots to the same aiming point. And there's some methods to do that that are actually really easy. And I know I won't spoil them too much because our shooting editor, Jon Snow, is working on getting doing a story on how to do that, because he kind of came up with this method that's really easy to do it with. In this 20 shot group size that you compile is not going to be nearly as nice looking as, you know, the 0.343 or 0.590 or 0.383 inch 3 shot groups you fire, but it's going to be accurate and it's going to tell you like realistic and reliable, like outer limits. Well, both outer limits and like if you calculate the mean radius, average impact locations out of that gun and that ammo. Like, that's actionable stuff. You know, I love shooting little groups, and you know, the groups you take a picture with and so you can have in your phone to brag on your rifle. Like, those groups are cool, but they don't really mean anything. And especially going the route of, because I still see posted like a lot of, you know, you know, people bragging on a rifle with a picture of a 3 shot group, and it's like, cool, you know, that's awesome, but it doesn't mean anything. And in fact, I would say, like, I say this maybe kind of like a little bit abrasively, but it, you know, a 3 shot group means less than nothing, is kind of how I think about it. Like, not only is it like meaningless in predicting what your gun will do, it's actually like can be more harmful if you lean on that, or you know, you can run into more problems by leaning on that and expecting and having that be your expectation, than if you just like ignored it, you know. Like, so in that way, it's like less than meaningless. It's like harmful, because, you know, like I'm looking at a target right now from this 7 PRC I shot the other day. The first 3 shot group out of it was 0.200. And a lot of us would just put the rifle down and say, yep, that's what this gun does, and that's good enough. But you are like, you're just asking for disappointment, because that's not basically what any guns do. Like, there's not quarter inch guns. Sorry, you know, and part of a lot of this, you know, maybe I've mentioned on this podcast before, but the way we describe some of these things, there's a lot of confusion and people get like about ready to throw fists over how we define stuff, you know. And the way, when I'm looking at my own load development or categorizing rifles, I have really gone to basically calling it what it will shoot like a 20 or 30 shot group aggregate in. You know, if you know, because that's accurate, like that's valid, and that's valid verified, like, you know, so like this Weatherby 307, their new like adventure, like fancy Woodstock model, which is a really nice looking rifle that I've just been shooting. I'm just peeling through these targets that I've got laying around on my desk. You know, one of that did shoot like 0.343, 0.383, 0.590, 0.617, 0.357, 0.644. You know, you would think, and the average 3-shot group size over 20 shots was, which was 0.556. So that's, I mean, and you'd think, well, that's a half inch gun, but really it's not a half inch gun. It's an excellent shooting gun, but you know, you correlate all those 20 shots or 21 shots, and it is, the overall group size is 1.09 inches, which, you know, there, you know, a lot of people just frame of mind and how you define guns accuracy or how you define a 1-inch gun. There's a lot of people that would be like, oh, well, my so-and-so can do that. My so-and-so can do that all day long. And like maybe it can, maybe it can't. And a lot of times they just don't hold up. So when you use larger sample sizes like this, your group sizes are going to be bigger and they're not going to look as pretty, but they're going to be much more informative to you. And they're going to help your, you know, as far as like the context of hand loading and load development, like they're going to tell you a lot more, and you're ultimately going to have to shoot less. You know, a big hold up with a lot of people, you start talking about these, you know, 20 shot sample sizes or using 20 shots in this way to zero, like get a really accurate zero for your rifle. You know, it does cost money. It's a, you know, ammo cost, it's not free, and it's time consuming, but expense and whatnot is an excuse a lot of times to not do this. Or hand loading, you know, oh, why would I load up a sample of 10 or even just start with a sample of 20? It seems counterintuitive, but with that, even if you just load that sample of 20, with that 20, you're going to know whether or not you have a load that's going to work for you or not, or you're going to be really, really close, maybe 30 shots total. Maybe you do a 10 and then a 20 shot sampler. So you're 30 shots in and you either know this is my load or I'm moving on. Whereas old ladder test methods or like the OCW test, that's 30 shots basically right there. Oh, and then you're going to fine tune maybe more around this node, do some more experiment. I mean, you might have 50, 60, 100 shots into your load development to either end up at the same place or right back where you started from, you know, scratching your head, wondering what's up. So it really does make a difference. And you know, even zeroing your rifle, like I mentioned, you know, you take your new hunting rifle, you're going to buy, you know, a couple boxes of ammo. You want to zero the thing. There are ways, like, you can, not to discount, you can get a practical hunting zero for your rifle in a few shots, you know, like you could do it in one or two shots a lot of times and be really, really close and be close enough to where it's going to work for most hunting situations. But it's just a matter of, are you okay with that? Are you okay living with that level of uncertainty? Because even using 3-shot groups to set your zero, if you're really good at it and really efficient, you know, you're going to be there in 6 shots or so, or like have it verified in 6 or 9 shots, but it's still not going to be quite right. It's still not, you know, your 3-shot group sizes or 5-shot group sizes vary too much. And move around just enough to where you're going to have some, like you're certain to have some error in there. But if you use an aggregate like 20 shot group or 30 shot group, or even just 15 shots to calculate your mean point of impact and adjust your zero according to that, it just is like much more valid and dependable information. And I'm really like rattling on a tangent there. One thing I didn't really talk about too much, I mean, a seating depth. Like I said, I have been for the last couple of years have just been seating everything to book spec. In, you know, there was days like service rifle, or I would try to like chase my lands I could only do it with 80 grain bullets because I'd you single feed those at the 600 yard line. But, you know, everything else, 77s, whatever bullets, you're limited. And in a lot of rifle cases, you're limited by magazine length, especially hunting rifles. So, like, there's not much point in chasing the lands. Now, what I would say is I do believe that there are, like, windows that, you know, like, with a given chamber or, like, average chamber design for a cartridge, like, there's a window in which a bullet should probably be seated or is going to function best. I mean, that's just a mechanical thing. But I don't really even buy into the seating depth nodes either, or like fine tuning. You know, maybe there's something to be gained from it, but like you'd have to shoot so much fucking ammo to like even find that, that like by the time you shoot it and find it, it's moved however many thousands because you've eroded the throat. I mean, I'm just super skeptical on the seating depth nodes, but I do think that like within certain windows, bullets are going to function better. And, you know, if you want to mess around with it, I think it's probably going to take like a big change in seating depth to show you any like perceptible results. Maybe that'll work for you. Maybe it won't, but there's just not like a magic 5,000th window where everything is great. And then outside of that, it sucks, or that it's like for most people, especially that it's going to be a perceptible difference. And there's things you can get into, like the closer, the tighter you are to the lands, or, you know, trying to do different stuff with your seating depth, you know, the farther your bullet is seated out as you like shoot through and erode lands, like the bigger the difference from one shot to the next, even though it is really small. So yeah, it's simple to load to like book spec, and I just kind of forget about it, and I have no problem shooting really good ammo. I mean, I would like to do a seating depth test kind of similar to the charge weight nodes when I get the time, but it is time consuming and takes hundreds and hundreds of rounds to really kind of figure out. But I am really enjoying learning, and have, I think, learned a lot about, you know, just rifle accuracy, or like realistic pictures of rifle accuracy, and my reloading game has been greatly simplified by this. You know, I mean, you want to see big changes, change the powder or change the bullet. You're just kind of wasting your time chasing ladders and doing all this like fine tuned stuff that that is very detail oriented. But it just doesn't seem to be, I don't know, it doesn't seem to make that much of a difference or any perceptible difference that I've seen. And for the level of precision that I need, like I want good shooting ammo and I like having good consistent ammo, but it's just not worth the extra time that I may or may not be wasting doing it. So that's the way I look at it. And I'm trying to think if there's anything else to kind of add, tack on the end here before I sign off, but that's pretty much, yeah, how I been operating and doing things. But shooting, oh, one thing that I will add that's kind of cool I've been experimenting with and plan on continuing is looking at how like shooting 3-shot groups and 5-shot groups might or might not change how a rifle performs accuracy wise because you know, and ultimately like would shooting a just running 20 shots, like not at a like speed demon pace, but like a, you know, 20 shots in 15 or 20 minutes, like you would be on the line at a rifle match, at a 600 yard match. How does that affect like the actual overall group size, 20 shot group size? I've been trying with 3 and 5 shot groups, and obviously the 5-shot groups average a little bit bigger, but the overall, when you correlate all the points into a 20 shot group, they basically in several rifles now, 7 PRC, this Weatherby 307 30-06, Ruger 6.5 Creedmoor, and a couple others. We did this a couple times at our gun test down in Arizona a couple weeks ago, but we're wanted to accumulate a bunch of data of comparing how does 20 shots of three-shot groups and 20 shots of five-shot groups compare, you know, with the barrel cooled between. And so far, they're, like, basically identical. Like, there's little differences, but they're not – I mean, they're within the variability of 20-shot groups. You know, you're still going to have some, you know, like maybe, like – 20 to 30% variability in 20 shot group sizes. It's much, much better than 10 or 5 or 3. Like these 3-shot groups, it's crazy how much they vary. And people sometimes are shocked by that. They, you know, the 7PRC one that I was using for an example, you know, I have everywhere, like same box of ammo, same conditions, same day, letting the barrel cool between. I have everywhere from 0.2 on the small end to I have a 0.889 immediately after that, and then like a 0.905 on the big end, on the larger end. Like those group sizes vary so much, and they move around. You know, this particular example, if I didn't say it already, has an average group size of 0.68 inches, which is I mean, normally I'd be like, damn, that's a good shooting, and it's not a bad shooting rifle. It's still the rifle is the same, but how like we really characterize it is different. You know, most people will look at that and say like that is freaking a Skookum shooting rifle. But if you tell them that, you know, oh, well, the overall dispersion of those 20 shots is 1.7 inches, then their tune changes. Then they start saying, oh, it looks like shooter error to me, when it's not fucking shooter error. Like I know, like I said, you know, when you're pull, if you're being honest with yourself, like, you know, when you pull shots and you know, when you don't, and you just kind of have to factor humor and error in, because it's present anytime you're shooting a gun, and be like, practically, like, this is what that load and rifle will do. And with that number of shots in the group, that group size, that group like data set, like, it will do it pretty consistently. It's not going to vary very much. And that's what I'm seeing between the 3 and 5 shot groups. You know, your 5 shot groups look, and they are bigger because, you know, you're adding more shots. So, like, you may get an idea that up with the 5-shot groups, they're bigger, so the gun's getting hot and things are changing. It's going wacko, when that's really not the case at all. It's just a factor of natural dispersion. The more shots you put in there, the more chance that you're going to start having some of your normal outlying shots, like in the periphery of your, you know, whatever, whoever calls it a cone of fire, and that's a really good way to describe it. So I'll probably just wrap it up with that, but it's fascinating. And eventually I want to, with some of these rifles, even some like thin barrel rifles, I want to try, just for shits and grins, you know, running 20 at once to see, does that make, 'cause my intuition tells me, and like all the dogmatic like indoctrination over the years tells me, like, I take a thin barreled hunting rifle and shoot 20 shots through it, it's going to go haywire. But will it? I don't know. We'll see. Thanks for listening, everybody.